Well, today I'd like to introduce Dion. I've known Dion for a while. I had a home group in Boca, which was Dion's home group, and I've always enjoyed listening to Dion share, especially like his take on spirituality and how it relates to this program and emotional sobriety and all that. And I want to thank Dion for coming up here, and here's Dion.
Hi, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. My name is Dion. Amen. Come into AA April 1st, 1968. Been clean and sober for 45 years. I have three daughters that really did well. They're out of the house, married. They really did well on the principles of the program. I'm getting old. I'll tell you how old I'm getting. I saw this beautiful young girl yesterday, and I'm thinking, her grandmother must be hot. So, that's where I'm at.
Well done.
I'm not an expert. I'm not an academic. But I'm a student of the program. I just love finding solutions. Because I didn't know peace of mind. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what serenity was when I came here. My head was like a bowl of mush. I was born in Bronx, New York City, 1939, baptized, confirmed in Mount Carmel Catholic Church. It was like the hub of Little Italy in the Bronx. And my parents... My mother was super responsible, you know, took two buses, two trains, worked in the millinery section in Manhattan, back again, cooked at night. My father was totally super irresponsible. He never had a real job, but the guy had great qualities. He didn't like to work. But he would dive off bridges, walk on his hands, sculpt. He was like, I don't know. He was an interesting guy, and I probably, I don't know if it was consciously, but I guess I grabbed onto the best of both of them. You know what they had, but they didn't drink, they didn't smoke, they didn't even drink coffee. They just argued 24 hours a day, you know, about the rent. And the more they argued, the better guitar player I would become. Because at the age of 10 years old, I asked my uncle to get me a guitar, and he got me this little guitar. So the more they'd argue, I'd go in the room and I'd play, you know. So I got quite good at it. I started getting these records and trying to imitate them, you know. And I come from this macho Italian neighborhood. You know, the whole code of the streets in the Bronx, the Fordham section, was like reputation and respect. That was it, man. You walk down the street and you go, the kid is here. What the hell do you want to know? You walk around like, for some reason in my mind, I thought I had to be born knowing everything. I don't know where I got this from. But I didn't know too much, you know, and the guys on the corner go, what, hey, yo, what's happening? Hey, man, I'm hit. What is happening, yo? And the reason why everybody asks what's happening, we didn't have the slightest idea. We didn't. I didn't know. So, but every time I passed Mount Carmel Catholic Church, there was this Bishop Monsignor Pettinacone. He used to stand outside the church and walk and say his prayers. And I'd be walking by, and I'm talking about, you know, as a young teenager, maybe 12, 13, 14, 15, and he said, yo, Dion, come over here. And I'd walk over, and he'd try to engage me. Everybody would run. The guys would run, but for some reason... He engaged me, so I'd go over and he'd say, what's this movie, Rebel Without a Cause? I'd say, hey, Monsignor, I had my collar up. I thought I was Rebel King of the neighborhood anyway, you know. I was like, yo, Monsignor, James Dean, this is a good movie, Monsignor, yo. Say, Dion, why rebel without a cause? Rebel for the truth, then you really got something. You know what I'm talking about, Dion? I said, oh, thanks for reminding me, Monsignor, thank you. I walk away, I'm thinking, what is truth? I had no idea what the hell he was talking about. The next day, I'd walk by and say, yo, Dion, come over here. What makes a man happy? I say, hey, Monsignor. Hey, this girl moved down from Vermont, this girl Susan. I said, if I could get a date with this righteous fox, Monsignor, I'm telling you, she's beautiful. If I could get a T-bird with leather bucket seats and wire chrome wheels, and if I could get a J200 guitar, if I could get a hit record, Monsignor, I'd be a happy guy. No, Dion, the virtuous man is a happy man. St. Thomas Aquinas. I'd say, oh, Monsignor, thanks for reminding me. I forget. Thanks. I'll see you later, Monsignor. And I walk away and I'm thinking, what the hell is virtue? I had no idea what he, you know. And then, you know, sometimes I'd walk over and say, what's virtue? And he would tell me. He would, you know, that was my problem. I'd ask him and I'd had a 20-minute discussion with the guy. You know, I still remember it till this day. It's a habitual and firm disposition to do the good. He used to say, you know what physical muscles are to, you know what muscles are to the physical body? Virtue are muscles for the soul. Dion, you gotta build, you know, and that's what, so when I came into AA, I'm fast forwarding. I asked my sponsor, what's the difference between virtue and practicing the principles? And he said, well, when you practice the principles long enough, you develop virtue. It becomes a habitual and firm. It's like you don't steal. You go, they don't need cops in the mall. You don't steal. You know, this kind of thing. So, I mean, I haven't gotten there yet. This is just, I'm defining stuff. You know, that's why I'm here. I'm just telling you that I didn't get it when I was a kid, did not get it, because the guys across the street, the cool of the neighborhood, the gangs, Ralphie Moach, Frankie Yunk-Yunk, Joe Beebe Eyes, yo, Dion, come, what are you doing with that guy with the gown, you know, the Monsignor had a gown on, you know, who, you can't wear a gown, he had like this black thing, you know. So I never went that route. I hung out with the guys, the Fordham Baldies, and that was, you know, it was the that was it. I always say that in my neighborhood, I belonged to the Italian gang. We were the warlords. There was the black gang. They were the royal lords. Then there was the Jewish gang. They were the landlords. And I belonged to the wrong gang. Now I'm starting to get it. So there's a lot of things I didn't get. But I loved the music trip. I fell in love with Hank Williams and Jimmy Reed when I was a kid. You know, I heard these records on radio, and I tried to, you know, imitate them with my guitar and start writing songs as a kid, you know. And I had a little gift for it. And what I used to do was I'd write a song, and I would make sense of the whole world. Within 3 minutes, I could write a song and resolve conflict. Like, my parents were always arguing. Always. They did not know how to talk to each other. Well, my father didn't work, and my mother worked hard. There was a real conflict there. So, you know, I'd write a song like, here I am, girl, standing in the rain. I'm going round inside a hurricane, baby. I want to ride with you. You know, don't you know exactly how I feel? My mind feels like it ain't got no driving wheel. Baby, I want to ride with you. Then I'd write some more verses. And at the end, I'd say, everybody's got to make a change sometime. My heart has turned towards the sunshine. And I'd go, I feel good. That's, you know, I'd resolve everything within the song, and it made the whole world make sense to me as a kid. And so I started playing at the church dances with the guitar and, you know, had a little group. But of course, you know, drugs came into my neighborhood. Now, you know, listen, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. What the book explains is a real alcoholic. I'm not a pure alcoholic, okay? So, I don't know what a pure alcoholic is, but that's me. So, you know, so drugs, you know, alcohol, it was my friend's father owned the liquor store. So every time he, you know, I started doing this stuff real young, 13 years old. I remember getting drunk at 13. I come out of this liquor store, my friend's house. His father was on vacation. He got a few bottles of vodka. We mixed it with chocolate syrup. It was, you know, I was 13. We didn't know. What the hell do I know? So I'm whacked out of my skull. And I come out, and I'm on Crotona Avenue in the Bronx. It was like one of the main drags. And I walk up Crotona Avenue on the white line in the middle of the street. And the tenement buildings are on each side of me. And I felt like I was running for, like, governor. You know, I'm like, yo, the kid is here. I'm, like, looking at everybody on the fire escapes in the neighborhood. Yo, hello. I got it, you know. I know everything. So, you know. And then I walked into the corner candy store, and this girl, Susan, was there, who had moved down from Vermont. And I'm married to this girl today. We're married over 50 years, you know. But I walked up to her and I started talking some, you know, what I thought was brilliant, of course. I don't know what I was talking about, but, you know, when I was like that, I felt like, because I come from a house or a home where they, you know, like, drinking really isn't my problem. It's like, I didn't know how to handle my emotions. I didn't even know what they were. Because, you know, my mother would say, don't feel that way. You're crazy to feel that way. It's stupid to feel that way. It's wrong to feel that way. Don't feel that way. I'm thinking, how the hell are you supposed to feel? I had these feelings. I didn't know where they came from or what. So I walk into the candy store. I'm whacked. I start talking to Susan. I'm brilliant. And she, you know, I think I know exactly. You know, I'm like, whoa. The kid is here, man. I'm really something. But I needed that. The next day I woke up, I needed more of that. It felt so good. I went back to it. You know, I wanted more of that stuff, whatever it was, you know. Because I didn't have to second guess my feelings when I drank. I didn't have to say, how do I feel? I just felt good. And what do you want to know? The kid is here. So I thought I just knew everything, you know, when I got stoned, you know. So I started, when I was about 17, I went downtown. But first of all, there was this black guy in my neighborhood. His name was Willie Green. He used to play guitar. He was like a superintendent of one of these tenement buildings. I loved this guy. I couldn't wait to get out of school so I could sit with him because he knew all these John Lee Hooker songs. And I don't know. I got hung up in this stuff. It just moved me. This, you know, blues and country music. It just, I don't know, something that would resonated with me. The teachers thought I didn't know what I wanted to do in junior high school, and I wanted to just get out of school and sit with Willie and learn a chord or two, you know. So at one point, there was this older guy in the neighborhood, and he brought me down to a record company, and Willie encouraged me, and I went in, I sang a song, they said, well, where'd you come from? And they signed me. I was like 17 years old, got my parents' permission, and started writing songs for these guys and recording, and I got successful. I mean, I got a check. I actually bought the Thunderbird and drove past Mount Carmel Catholic Church, and Monsignor was like, yo, Monsignor. you know, and Susan was sitting next to me. You know, I had it made, so I thought. And I actually hit the top of my profession, you know, maybe 1963. I was on a roll and quite good at what I was doing. You know, I got about 12 gold records. And when I was 1959, when I was about, you know, I guess 19 years old, went on tour with a a bunch of other rockers, and this one guy was 22, and he chartered a plane. Well, I mentioned Buddy Holly. I was on tour with Buddy Holly, and some of you guys know, younger guys are going, who the hell is he? But back then, this guy was quite a stately kind of fearless kind of old soul kind of guy. He was 22 years old, and he wanted to charter a plane because we were crisscrossing the Midwest, and it was below zero, and we were riding in a little yellow school bus, and this guy decided to charter a plane. Well, he was from Lubbock, Texas. His older brothers, flew planes, and he was taking lessons out at Teterboro Airport in New Jersey when he moved to New York. Anyway, he wanted to charter a plane. It's incredible now that I think about it, because what 22-year-old even today wants to charter a plane? I mean, first of all, you know, we were from poor neighborhoods. You know, this guy, but he chartered a plane in Clear Lake, Iowa. And, you know, it had four seats, and it could only seat a certain amount of guys, so we flipped a coin. I won a coin toss, and when he told me it would cost $36, because the headliners at a tour he was trying to recruit guys to pay the sum of the flight. It was only a 2-hour flight from Clear Lake to Fargo. I thought $36. This is what my parents argue about all the time. The rent, $36. Pat, get a job. Pat, get a job. I said I can't get on it. So I gave my seat to another guy, and the plane crashed and killed all aboard, including the pilot, and I was like the only survivor of, you know, the headliners on that tour. Three guys died. So I was baffled. I was 19 years old. I'm asking myself, what, you know, who am I? What's life about? Where am I going? What the hell is going on? You know, I was just on the top of the world for the last 2 weeks with these guys. You know, we were like, rock, and we were like on the top of the world. What's going on? What is life? I'm sitting on the bus alone. I'm looking at their outfits, their hats, their guitars, gone. I'm thinking, oh, what do? I don't think too much. I go get a bottle, you know, and pop a few pills, whatever the hell I had, you know, and that's the way it was. And I stayed on the anyway, we finished out. Let me not get into a long story about that, but I didn't know anything about grieving or handling my emotions or talking or anything like that. And nobody asked me when I got home. No one. Hey, good to see you. You know what Joey said? That was it. You know, it was like off and running. So I didn't come from, you know, there was no grief counseling in 1959. You know, there was no, there was none of this. So I'm drinking, and I'm quite successful. I'm getting more successful. I'm having hit records with, I moved to Columbia Records, which now is Sony. I was like the first rock and roll artist signed to Columbia Records. So I'm having a dinner with Susan. She's not my wife yet, and she's seeing all these interviews, and you know what? I'm trying to impress this girl. I'm trying to like get close to her any way I could, and trying to show her how important and how, you know, impress her. And she says to me, "Could I ask you something?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." She said, "And we're at a beautiful restaurant. We have Bordeaux and Beaujolais." I thought I was getting culture. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. You know, I'm like ordering wines that I heard, you know, this will impress her. But she said to me, "Is this all you want?" I said, you know, here we are at a great restaurant, and I have an apartment in Manhattan now. Is this all I want? I knew she was asking me something profound, but I hadn't the slightest idea what the hell it was. She said, is this it? Is this it? I'm thinking, I can't tell you I knew what was happening with me, but I got frightened that I was going to lose her, so I asked her to marry me. I got on the offense. Let's get, yo, honey, let's get married, baby. I'll love you forever. I'll change. I'll do whatever you want, baby. Yo, the kid, whatever you want. And she bought it. And we got married. March 25th, 1963. And the drugs and alcohol got really bad from there till 1968. 5 years was like hell. And you guys know, anybody who's hit a bottom knows what I'm talking about. Man, the bleakest, darkest emotional period of my life. You know, the book calls it a soul sickness. Self-will run riot. It's like, I never knew, you know, the book says irritable, restless, discontent. And then the fourth step says we're self-seeking, selfish, dishonest, fearful, inconsiderate, totally inconsiderate. I didn't know she was in the room after these 5 years. Believe me, I didn't know that anybody else had feelings. It was all about me at the end of my drinking. I was like, you know how you do it when you keep drinking and you're looking, and you're using and you're abusing, and you start doing life by blaming everybody and putting guilt on everybody. Why don't you? You know what's wrong with you? You know, why don't you, you know what, you never, why do you always, you're always like that, you know, that's the way you do life. So in this whole thing, my wife decides to get help for herself. What nerve. She goes to, I don't know anything about it, somebody talked to her, she goes off to Al-Anon, unbeknownst to me, I have no idea. She comes back. I said, where were you? She said, I went to an Al-Anon meeting. What'd you do that for? I went for help for myself. For yourself? Well, I start yelling and getting angry. You know, what a threat that is. Now, I don't even know what being threatened means. You know, all I know is I'm in the fight mode. I'm in the blaming mode. You got to put guilt on everybody. I didn't know how to do life. My head was like a bowl of mush. I was like a self-centered wretch. You know, I found out later that I thought freedom was doing anything you wanted, especially if you didn't get caught. Freedom is the ability to choose God's best. I was never free to do that. I was always in bondage to the drugs, the sex, the whatever it was, you know, the fame. Fame, power, it's like money is... It's like a narcotic in itself running after that stuff. So, anyway, she met Lois at a meeting, 1967. She comes back. This woman told her, say four things and nothing else until I see you again. Run these four things by your husband. And if he bothers you, repackage them and say them again. So she does, and I start yelling at her. She looks at me. She says, honey, I love you. She says, baby, I thought I could help you. I can't. I found out that I can't help you. But, number three, she says, there is a fellowship that knows your problem and has the solution. Number four, excuse me, I got to get the orange juice. And she takes off. So I run after her and I start yelling. What the heck? What? You know what's wrong with you? You always, you never, you. She turns around. She says, baby, I'm not the enemy. I care about, I've been trying to help you for 5 years. Number two, honey, they told me I'm powerless. I can't help you. Do you know how frustrating that is? I have no power to help you. She says, number three. But there is a fellowship. They know what's wrong with you. They had the problem themselves. They know the way out. They know it. The room opens from the inside. They have the key. You have the key. Excuse me, I got to get the eggs. I run after her and I start yelling at, well, this went on all week. She repackaged the four things. Well, it's hard. It's very difficult to argue with somebody who got your number and doesn't want to engage and doesn't buy your bullshit anymore. So I was like hanging out there. This woman detached with love and with some kind of understanding. And I didn't want to lose her, I guess, you know, somewhere. And I asked for help. I went to a meeting with a guy. And I went in, and they were talking about prayer. And they were laughing. They were like, oh, I got divorced for you. Yeah. And I'm thinking, they're talking about their defects, their fears, and everybody's laughing. And I'm thinking, oh, man, this is all this stuff that they're talking about. I never want to see the light of day, and God forbid anybody should know that I'm frightened. God forbid. You don't, in the Bronx? What are you kidding? You walk up and say I'm frightened? Get out of here. You get your head kicked. You get a knock right in your, you get a dent in your skull. You tell anybody, you know. Yo, frightened? Me? I knew nothing of this word surrender. You know, to me it meant running away, but they were talking about a surrender, running to something, running to a loving God, running to, it says, there's one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And I got to tell you, when I came in, religion wasn't like, whoa, you know, like you got to make up your own God. My sponsor grabbed me. Of course, the first book I got when I came into AA was AA Comes of Age. And I saw Bill Wilson was sponsored by a priest for 15 years, Father Ed Dowling. And he was discipled by Bishop Sheen for a year. And Dr. Bob, these guys were like, they believed in the God of the Bible. Today, it's like you can make up your own God. I mean, I hear some people get up, they go, you could create your own. No, that's what got me here, creating my own God. No, I reduced God to my own vain philosophy. No, you can't do that. So they used to say, my sponsor used to say, it doesn't say God as you make them up. It says God as you understand them. And it's not as you understand God. We don't worship our understanding. It's God as you understand them. And they were talking about the God of the scriptures back when I came in. I don't know, you know, that's what they were doing. So they told me straight up, they said, Dion, God created you in such a way only to work well when you're in union with him. Now, I used to say to my sponsor, I didn't know what the hell that really meant, but, and he would constantly use this word union. He would say, the 12 steps are designed to lead you into union with God. And this will really help you, Dion. This is healthy. This will give you power because, you know, you read the 11th step, you see where the power, you know, there is one who has all power. So these steps will position you to receive this free gift. So my sponsor, when I started thinking about it, you know, then I started thinking because I didn't know how to think. But I started to learn and I saw that having an outside reference to your life is a great thing for a man to have. I mean, the Pope has an outside reference to his life. The president, any CEO worth his weight in salt, it has an outside. They sit down, they share their fears, their mistakes, they ask for help. No, not an alcoholic. An alcoholic's like, what are you bothering me for? No, I know. You know shit, you know. You know, I knew nothing. And I'm like, I know, get off my back. I know. Oh, my God. I want to tell you something. I'm going to share something with you. You're going to get pissed at me, but I'm going to share it with you. In my group, there was a guy who had a lot of money, made a lot of money. And he would stand in the back of the room before the meeting finished, and he would collect guys. You know, it was like a little cult there, you know, the money cult. And when the downturn came, I don't see those guys around anymore. Man, they didn't know what to hang on to, because God is God and money is money. You can't, like, you know, if your peace of mind is in your bank account, it's going to fluctuate. It's going to fluctuate. If your peace of mind is on anything other than God, it's going to fluctuate, and it's going to go up and down, and you're going to get depressed. And that's another thing. I got to tell you this. My sponsor, man, he led me through these steps, and he told me, he said, Dion, he said, feelings come from thoughts. I didn't know that. I swear to you, I did not know that. So he used to say, sure, you're walking down the street and you're saying, oh, I'm getting old, my nose is getting big, I don't have this, and my eyes, I don't have a job, and I did that bad, and she did. By the time you hit the corner, you're looking to blow your brains out. He said, your feelings come from your thoughts. You'll feel anything you're thinking. That's why you feel so good in a meeting, and that's why you feel so good when you have a spiritual awakening. Because you're thinking on things above. You're thinking on beauty and truth and goodness and vision and passion. And it's that spiritual awakening that just puts a warm blanket around you. And by the time you hit the corner, you're going, you know, it's a great day. Look at how beautiful it is here, you know. It's great to have friends. It's good. Well, anyway, I'm in the program, and I get on my knees. Well, I got on my knees. I said a prayer, and I kid you not, man, I was very blessed. I believe what my sponsor said when I came in. He said, ask God for help. And I got on my knees, and I asked. And by the way, asking is a prayer, and it's all through the big book. Ask God. Ask God. Ask God. It's like, that's what praying is. So I asked God, I said, you know, I need help. And I kid you not, man, I haven't had he took away the obsession to drink and drug. And it's been 45 years, and I just thank him for that. Now, when I came in, when I sat in meetings, I started working the steps, I realized that I had three main resentments. Hey, I know I'm going long, but could I? Keep going. I'm getting out 5 minutes. I'm trying to wrap it up. But I have I had three main resentments: my parents, religion, the church, and I'm Italian. I hated Italians. I didn't even know it. I kid you not. I kid you not, I grew up on a street and I had some, you know, I had some interaction with some guy. I just didn't like, I thought they, you know, let me not get into it, but this is what I came up on. It says, list people, places, institutions, whatever. I put them down. So when my sponsor met my mother, he said, yeah, and I love my mother. She's 99 today, you know. She's unbelievable. She said, Dion, take that beard off. It makes you look old. I said, Ma, I'm 74. I want a beard. Could I grow a beard? She's the same. Anyway. So she's still trying to control the world. She sits on the throne and she runs the world. And my sponsor said, that woman is hiding some deep psychological weaknesses. You better get away from her because she'll kill you if she doesn't go for help. Now, I didn't know what he was talking about. but I kind of, you know, I listened to my sponsor, so I unplugged the approval machine. You know, I went to my family, I said, I'm resigning. And everybody said, resigning from what? I said, I'm resigning for feeling responsible for everybody. You know, I said, I'm going to take the position of a loving son. My sponsor told me to say this, so I said it. An accountable, loving son. My mother said, what are you resigning from? I said, feeling responsible for everybody. She said, ooh, you shouldn't feel responsible for it. I said, I know, that's why I'm resigning. So I unplugged the approval machine. And, you know, my sponsor used to say, hey, listen, I don't want to hear about your parents anymore. They might be the architect of all your problems, but you're responsible for the reconstruction, you know, so get busy. And then somewhere in there, I went to Italy, and wow, I saw the history and the architecture and the music and the church and the love and the food and the spirituality and the poetry and the art, and I had a great time, and I started visiting the cathedrals, and something happened to me, man. Something happened to me. I had a spiritual awakening. I asked God, I said, God, it would be nice to be closer to you. And man, he opened up heaven to me. And I started going to church. Now, who would ever think a guy like me would go to church? And I love kneeling. I love worship. That's one thing you can't do in AA, because they would think you're nuts if you got on your, you know, your stuff. But I don't get me wrong. AA is my, you know, it's like my foundation. They accepted me when I didn't know anything. When I was a man, I was just so into myself. I can't tell you. It was bad. I had guys yell at me, you know, sit down, shut up. You don't know anything about life. Shut the fuck up. I mean, excuse the language, but that's the way they talk to me. You don't know anything. You want to leave, leave. But take the cotton out of your ears, shove it in your mouth. Oh, man, they were rough on me. But I needed it. You want to know something? One guy was so brutal that I was going to punch his lights out, man. I swear. But I respected the guy so much that I went to it. He said, why don't you come over to the house tonight? He lived like, I don't know, two blocks from me. But I went, because I said, you want to know something? I'm going to put your face through the, you know. I was like, he said, why don't you come over to the house tonight? We'll talk. Well, after leaving his house, I felt like I was on, I can't tell you, man. I felt like I was on holy ground. This guy mowed lawns for a living. And I was an arrogant son of a bitch, man, I tell you. I was frightened. I didn't know it. I didn't know how frightened I was to get close to people. But I didn't know how to do that. And thank God for his love, for his patience, for his caring, his understanding. And he wasn't intimidated, thank God, because he had the truth. And when you have the light, nothing stands up. You got to run. You know, I'll tell you one thing I learned, that I was sitting with a group of people one day, and somebody said, love begets love. And my sponsor said, no, it doesn't. Sometimes it doesn't. He says, you know, unconditional love demands a response, and some people can't take it. They run. They'll turn, they'll run, they'll push back. They're going to fight you. They don't know how to receive it. God's love, my love, whatever it is. And I didn't know that. I didn't know how to think. I didn't even know what these concepts meant. But thank God for my, and my sponsor's a wordsmith. He defines words. You know, he always said to me, Dion, don't confuse approval with love. They're two different things. If you confuse him, you're going to always be looking for approval. And my sponsor's a wordsmith. The first thing I went over to, when I found this out, I went over to him, I said, Ben, I said, see that guy? He's a real jerk off. Ben said, no. He said, I don't think so-and-so's a jerk. I believe his perception of reality is colored and skewed by his limitations. I said, that's what I said. He's a jerk off. Anyway, I was a jerk off. I didn't know too much. And here I am on a Saturday morning. Man, I don't even have a hangover. I'm feeling like peaceful. I'm feeling home. I'm feeling God's love, His peace, His presence. I thank you for listening to me. Thank you guys for coming out. Bye-bye.